Okay, welcome to another issue, another show of Common Ground. We have some really great guests here today, Sherry. Sherry, of course, is in the house. We're continuing our election coverage. Last week was pretty exciting to our candidates here. We have about 4,000 views on last week's show, and that was just the Denton County Commissioner's race. So hopefully we could generate a lot of views for your constituents and they can see what you're all about. We have the candidates for HD 67, Democratic primary, with Rocio Hernandez and Tom Adair and Anthony Lowe. Lorenzo Sanchez was going to make it, in full disclosure, and he had a family emergency, so he couldn't be here today. So those who want to find out about Lorenzo can check out his website. But we're here to talk to these great candidates who are willing to put their time on the line for the constituents of their community, and we welcome them. Give you each about a minute to tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're running for office. Let's start with Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, Steve and Sherry. Thanks for this opportunity to be here. My name is Tom Adair. You know, you had talked about giving a little bit of a bio. I'm a graduate of UT Law and Dartmouth College, and I'm a business lawyer and resident of Plano. I'm also a former congressional aide, so I worked on Capitol Hill for several years.
Yeah, which congressman was that?
So his name is Tom Petri.
Okay.
He retired in 2014, and one of the that's part of my story. May take a little while, but
you only get a minute.
Yeah, we're going to run out of time real quick. He was a moderate Republican from Wisconsin, and so I worked for 3 years for him. He retired in 2014 when he was being primaried from the right. He had been there about 35 years.
So he's a moderate Republican.
Yeah, so very moderate Republican, and I appreciated his ability to work across the aisle and solve problems. I worked on Capitol Hill and had that experience in terms of writing and enacting legislation, helping constituents solve their problems with the federal government, and also working with administrative agencies to address issues in the district and statewide in terms of heading up state delegation efforts. I'm running now because for the last several years, my values have been under attack, and I think our values have been under attack. I look at it, are we going to help the most vulnerable in our community? Are we going to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to live their American dream? Are we simply going to treat each other with decency and respect? So that's why I really appreciate what you're doing here in terms of this show and called Common Ground, because I truly believe that what we
you're going to ring the bell. I saw you going to ring the bell there for a second.
I hope we get to ring it a lot. But I really believe that we have a lot more in common than that which divides us. And I'm very frustrated with the really dogmatic and extreme approach taken by the legislature over the last few years.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to get to talk about, because I know that's a big problem with both parties, really. The people that are running against incumbents on the Republican side, they have the same comments. But thank you for that. Sorry to interrupt you there. Rocio, is it Rocio?
Rocio, yes.
Rocio, thank you. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. So I was fortunate enough to move to North Texas during the Civil War in El Salvador. My family moved here in the 80s, and the place we were escaping obviously was one, because it was in a civil war, that was not a safe community to grow up in. It was a place where people worried about their children being recruited as child soldiers or being lost in massacres. And you certainly didn't speak up against the state because they could make you disappear. So it was a completely different world that we came from. And North Texas was really our refuge. We got to grow up in a community that was safe. We had access to an incredible public education. I was able to go on to Baylor and then to Notre Dame Law School on a scholarship. And both of my sisters also have their master's degrees. And we really credit our professional success and our ability to do what we love and offer a lot to the community on that public education that gave us the good start, everything from learning to speak English to really providing the foundation so that we could succeed in college. I'm raising my family here now. I have two daughters. One is in kindergarten, so that was a little unnerving to send her to school, but she's doing great. She's in a very good school. Her teacher got Teacher of the Year, so she's really doing a good job there. My little one is still in daycare. She's going to the one that her sister went to. We trust everyone there. But I want this place to, you know, my community, District 67, to remain the kind of place I grew up in, where you know your kids are safe, where you know that everyone is going to have an opportunity to achieve their dreams because they have access to a fantastic public education, and that it's a community that's affordable to live in. I don't want our teachers, our police officers, the people who make some of the greatest sacrifices in our community to be priced out of the homes in District 67. And so I think we need to do things to make sure that wages are sufficient, to make sure that our schools are well-funded, and to make sure housing costs are affordable so that we maintain the community that we've had.
All right. Thank you so much. And Anthony, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Hey, everyone. I'm Anthony Lowe. I'm born and raised.
Nice voice. Yeah. Man. Wow. Right? That's not fair to these other candidates. Go ahead.
Can I tell you all a funny story with that?
Sure.
So summer between sixth and seventh grade, I went back to middle school in seventh grade. And then the first day of school, when I spoke, everybody said, "Wow, Anthony, you sound like a completely different person." Within the week of getting the schedule the week before for your classes, and then the first day of school, somehow my voice changed within a week. And then people would call my house's voicemail just to hear my pipsqueak voice from elementary school that I recorded in first grade.
That's
so
funny.
I don't know, it just happened within a span of a few days somehow in middle school. But all right. I'm Anthony Lowe. So born and raised in the district, born and raised in Plano. I went to Plano Senior High. My first high school basketball game was against Allen High in the district, and spent a lot of time in Richardson as well growing up. I was a substitute teacher before in Plano ISD and taught full time at a high school in Oak Cliff. And I worked at the state capitol as well. So I'm really focused.
Were you a lobbyist, or you worked for
I worked for a representative on a lot of legislation.
Okay.
So Michelle Beckley.
Okay. She's up for re-election. She has a challenger too.
Yeah.
We'll get her on the show, hopefully.
Yeah.
Anthony, can you help his sister and brother out on this?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I'll connect you. She's a great person. She's got a good heart, a great fighter. Can't say enough good things about her. So I'm really focused on average person's day-to-day needs. I want to make sure healthcare premiums go down. That's affecting everyone. I want to make sure traffic goes down so that, you know, you can get home to your loved ones, spend more time with them, and make sure the DMV line shortened. And I especially want to make sure that our education stays top notch for everyone. We got a changing job market in the future. So I feel like we've got to add a little bit more technology education to keep our kids competitive in that future job market. So that's something I really want to do. And also, core principle to everything I do, or every legislation that I want to pass, is just opportunity for everyone, rich and poor. You should be able to make it to the place in life that you want to be in, regardless of where you start.
Yeah, so let's just talk about that, and we'll start the conversation. It seems like from the position that I read from the four of you, I know Lorenzo's not here, it seems like there's a skew between those who are well off and those who are not. And that's the positions, I believe. Tom, I'm not sure if you really presented that in the information area, but I know the other three candidates have. So tell us, like, okay, we'll start Rocio. How would you, you know, you go into Austin, what are the first things you would do to try and make it an equitable lifestyle for all different types of classes? What's that first thing that you would do? And then I like to hear the other candidates, how they would respond to her. They agree or they have differences?
I think if you look at a family's spending in the form of a pie chart, a graph or something like that, you will see that healthcare costs, education costs, and housing costs are three of the biggest components. And so that's why those three issues to me need to be addressed to make sure that people A, earn enough, and B, don't spend too much. And so those are three things that I think if we have more people who have affordable health care, that's going to just absolutely transform lives. We know that one of the primary reasons that people file for bankruptcy is because they have too many outstanding medical bills.
So that's what the first thing that you would hit is the Medicaid and that health benefit system in the state. I'm just trying to narrow it down because those are three important topics you brought out. But you're in there that first year and you're like, this is what I'm going to concentrate, give the people in my constituency ability to have more money in their pocket and not worry about the medical. Is that basically what you're saying?
That is. And I'm certain that my profession influences my perspective. I deal with a lot of people who have been injured either being assaulted or being in an 18-wheeler collision or however it is that they've been injured. And I get to hear from them firsthand every day what their health insurance company is saying to them, or, you know, how they're having to tap into their savings to cover bills. I get the sticker shock with them when they get a $2,600 bill for a CT scan. And so since I'm in the trenches professionally, with the effects of the cost of healthcare on our community, I think that's part of why it's such a priority to me.
Okay. So Tom, these are, what do you think about what Rocio said, and is that what you would do, and how would, if it is the same, then how would you go and create legislature to make it better for your constituents?
Sure. I mean, when you talk about opportunity, and it really does come down to, I think the two biggest issues that the legislature is going to be facing this next session, and probably most sessions, it's healthcare and education. And we can talk about education a little bit later, but in terms of making sure we have strong schools and opportunity and good job training there. With the healthcare, I think, you know, we have a healthcare crisis in the state right now. And Rocio hit on one important aspect, and that is the number one leading cause of bankruptcy in this country is due to a healthcare crisis. And we have a crisis in the state with the highest uninsured rate in the country. And because we have such a high number of Texans that are uninsured, we have some of the highest medical costs. So if we are able to expand healthcare coverage, it will help everyone. So even people who have like a Cadillac health insurance plan right now in Texas and feel pretty good, their costs will come down as well if we are able to expand that pool.
So you're looking at state subsidies? I mean, how would you come about that?
Well, the number one.
And I'd like to ask before you answer that, because it kind of goes with it, is when we are the lowest of insured population, does that, it has to be because of our location. I mean, we're right next to the border. Is that together? And if so, how do we fix that? It's not just a simple matter of how do we fix healthcare for Texans. If we identify that that number of the lowest insured has more than to, because we're right next to the border, then it's more also, it's not just a healthcare issue, you know, like it's an immigration issue also.
Well, we can talk about that also.
I know, but I think when we start throwing out these numbers that Texas has the lowest number of independently insured, we have to keep in mind that there's another component to that. We can't just say Texas healthcare system sucks really bad because it's the lowest, if that lowest number has a lot more things going on.
Well, yeah, we can talk about the causes for that, and why we are at the lowest in terms of number of insured in the state, but the single, or in the country, but the single biggest reason is because this state is one of the few, and I believe it's 14, that have not expanded Medicaid. And if we expanded Medicaid, that would be, that is the single simplest step that this state can take to expand coverage and lower costs. And that's what is an imperative. And it's fiscally irresponsible and it's morally wrong to not do this. I believe we have a moral imperative to expand coverage to our most vulnerable people. And that's what this would do. Right now, we are foregoing $10 billion in federal funds and that are going elsewhere that could be used to expand coverage for Texans. And we're saddling our doctors in our hospitals with $6.8 billion in unpaid medical bills.
We'll stay on healthcare. Anthony, why don't you give your response to that? Then I want to bring it. I want to still stay on healthcare because I have some questions.
I added the side rabbit hole. Yeah. You hate when I do that.
So Anthony, go ahead. What is your position? Let's stay with healthcare. And so how would you make it better, I guess, for your constituents regarding healthcare? I think you all agree what Rocio said. Mm-hmm. That it costs a lot, and that's where people are losing their funding, their assets, or whatever their monetary values. So why don't you tell us, you know, your position on that?
Right. So healthcare is the number one issue I want to work on, and it can affect anyone, even upper middle class residents in Plano or Allen or Richardson. I met a family over this past weekend. Their daughter got sick. Their premiums jacked up to $1,000 a year with $15,000 deductibles. A lot of people can't afford that, you know, no matter what neighborhood you're in, if you have a two-story home. So the main thing we have to do is to put in preventive care, because our nation spends $3 trillion, 80% of our health spending nationally on chronic conditions. Chronic conditions meaning long-term medical conditions that don't necessarily kill you, but they're continually ailing you, so you need continual treatment. So if we expand insurance and have preventive care to stop it from getting to that point, then the overall pool costs will come down so that healthcare premiums are affordable. So my number one focus is preventive care.
So how would you have the state contribute to preventive care? What would be your idea? You go into legislature and you come up with something. What is your proposal to your fellow legislators?
Right. So accessibility, insurance, number one, we need to expand.
Sort of what Tom said.
Yeah. But that might be, so my experience working at state capitol, that's something I worked on a lot, but that's going to be really, really hard to do, even if there's a Democratic House majority. So we got to take a little bit of a chip away approach in terms of expanding a little piece at a time, because they're not going to accept Medicaid, unfortunately, even though it's $100 billion of federal.
So what is the reason why the state, I'll leave it, anybody want to chime in, why the state isn't expanding Medicaid? What is the political reason, I guess, behind it?
I'm going to disagree a little with Anthony on that. I believe that if the Democrats take the state house, that Republicans are going to come to the table and they're going to feel the need to expand Medicaid. What that expansion looks like, I don't know. It may not be a full-fledged expansion, but I think we're going to get a very large.
So what is the reason why the Republicans are?
That would be a political reason. They're going to feel
I was going to say, do you believe they're going to be doing that because all of a sudden they really do care about the situation? Or are you saying they're going to do that because then it becomes a political move because the majority will be held?
Well, it's a political move right now. They're not expanding Medicaid simply because it was made possible under Obamacare. So it is a dogmatic approach.
So you think it's strictly 100% political. So they're saying Obama wanted us to do this. We're not doing it because Obama wanted it.
There's one aspect there, and that is they'll argue that there's state – that they'll put up a facade and argue about the cost to the state, because under Medicaid, the state will pay 10%.
Right.
The federal government will pay 90%. Actually, under Obamacare, there were 3 years where the feds would have paid 100%, but we've missed that
one. Weren't there other things tied to that, though? And I, from what I remember reading, and I want Rosie to answer.
I was going to say, because she wanted to.
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead. I'll let you go. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I understand Anthony's position, but I do think there's more interest across the aisle in this. And part of the reason is because other states have gone first, and we've seen that in other states it's a success. That is the cost saver, that it does lower the burden of healthcare costs. So now that we have proof from other states going first that it is an effective way to regulate healthcare costs and expand coverage, I think there's more of an interest in it than there was even just a few years ago, just because we have that model of success in other states.
And I would jump in. I mean, talking about the fiscal aspect, I mentioned how much federal funds were, passing on right now, but I think it's also fiscally irresponsible because the projections show that we would be receiving more, and about $1.78 would come back into the state treasury for every dollar that the state would spend in expanded Medicaid. So, I think it's morally wrong in terms of failing to expand Medicaid, but also it's fiscally irresponsible not to do the same.
I want to interject for a second. So I think, let me backtrack a little bit. I think it is possible, actually, if we do take a majority, but we got to have backup plans, I think, is the approach that we need to have. Because, working at the state capitol, I think the number one mistake you can make as a freshman legislator is if you go for idealism and the most ideal legislative policy that you want, because those are very, very difficult to do. So the approach I would take is I would file for that and hope for the best, but I also want to have backup plans to make progress in the short term while also fighting very hard for the long-term ideal policy. And, that's a way that I would approach it to be an effective legislator.
Sure. A lot of
and are any of you for the single pay? I thought I read one of you, maybe it was Lorenzo, who's not here.
I know Lorenzo is
single, but are three of you for single pay, or you just want to make it more competitive? Is that
right? And I
don't
want
to talk for anybody.
I view that as more of a federal issue. But I have some reservations about single.
And I think you did bring up a good point, and I'm not trying to give any credit to Tom. He mentioned on his website about the telemedicine. Do you want to just talk about that? And then I'd like your responses to what you think of Tom's idea with telemedicine and making it more available to Texans?
Yeah, and I think that's just a somewhat simple approach, and that would really help expand access, especially for people in rural areas. I think we should try and expand the possibilities for using telemedicine as much as possible under whether it's a state plan, but also helping insurance companies do that. I know that a lot of insurance companies already do that to some extent, but I think we need to come up with a way to make it possible for people to actually consult with a doctor and get, you know, a prescription and things like that through telemedicine. And I think this day and age, to me, there's not a big difference between a video conference with someone if I'm still seeing someone on a screen. And so if I'm not in person with them, it's not as big a deal. Now, there is one caveat.
Okay, what's the caveat?
Well, I was actually going to say there are things like blood pressure monitoring and even measurements that a nurse might need to take. But there are programs around this country where you have nurse practitioners and other nurses in rural communities in particular who staff a clinic that there may not be a doctor for, but the patient can then consult with a doctor over the phone, or even better, like Skype.
You want to say something, Anthony?
Yeah, telemedicine, absolutely crucial, especially in the rural areas, even in the urban areas when people are on hourly jobs and they can't skip their job or else, you know, they're going to miss rent, they're going to miss food for their kids. Absolutely crucial. And that's one component on my website that I put down that is absolute critical part of the infrastructure to put in preventive care, because that brings access so that people can get with their primary care physicians to stop those chronic conditions from happening. So I'm all in for telemedicine. And, you know, I actually want to take this conversation a little bit further. I was just talking with my friend that I worked with at the legislator yesterday. And, you know, I'll be honest, I'm a little bit critical of the Democratic Party's marketing arm. We can do much better at marketing. And I think we need to be much more uniform messaging, starting at the city council to mayor, to state rep, to congressional, to governor, to senator races. We need to be uniform in saying, we want to protect your health care, because the rural areas are, you know, suffering through a lack of it. Their towns are shutting down because once the hospital leaves, once the doctor leaves, then it's not an area you can live in, because the medical providers are gone, so that they don't have any doctors and people move out. So if we start talking in terms of that and saying we want to provide health care, we want to make sure your town doesn't spiral out and you can preserve the hometown that you love. I think if we go from statewide down to the city level, that is an absolute killer message that can make us one from the senator to the governor all the way down. So that's what I would do if I was in charge of the Democratic Party marketing arm.
So we went to from health to marketing. That was interesting. But I'd like to go ahead.
A point. But I will add the whole telemedicine. It's not just the poverty stricken. I mean, my friends from when my kids were toddlers and littles, you know, I was able to stay home with my kids. And I had so many girlfriends that, you know, they had to work. And these were like well-established career women. But when that child comes down with the flu, somebody has to stay home. You know, that could be for a week, and you have, you know, two or three kids. It's a reality for everybody. So anyway, I just wanted to add that to the conversation. But I want to know about the telemedicine. What do we do about the opioid situation? Because that is an area that is exploited when it comes to that conversation. So I don't know if that's a question we need to ask them. I'm just kind of throwing it out there, like telemedicine, I don't know, is necessarily the be-all and all answer.
I mean, the opioid is more a federal issue. I mean, I think the state gets involved and the feds are trying to.
I guess what I'm trying to say, is it responsible to say, okay, let's as a state go get all of this telemedicine if it's not managed?
Yeah, that's a whole show discussion. Let's not stay on that.
I don't know. But it is a reality. If they're all saying, hey, telemedicine is the way to go, I guess I want to hear, is this an area that you're contemplating and keeping?
I would just clarify that I'm not necessarily saying it displaces what we do.
Right.
It's just an expansion.
There we go. See, Tom needed a chance to answer that way.
Very nice. So I'm going to move the topic that you all have different opinions on. Well, some of them are pretty close, but let's talk about education. So, Rocio, why don't you tell us about your education platform and what you'd like to see as a legislator?
Sure. So I want to see schools that are well-funded. And what does that mean? Well, it means that we're able to pay our teachers enough. We have more and more educators who may be fantastic teachers, but they don't have the certifications. They don't have the educational requirements. They didn't, you know, get certified to teach that age group or whatever reason. We're putting them in a classroom after saying you have to meet X criteria. We're allowing flexibility because we cannot attract enough people who want to become educators. They know, for example, their benefits package, which is a lot of the lore of taking a government job, has pretty much stagnated since 2001. I mean, we're talking about 20 years now that they haven't seen additional or proportionate benefits keep up with regards to, for example, their health insurance premiums. And so if we're offering less of a benefits package to these educators, if we're allowing our state to fall behind several thousand dollars behind the national average, how are we going to keep good people teaching our kids?
So what are some of your recommendations?
I mean, we have used the state fund in smaller and smaller proportion. I want to say it's since 2006 or seven. And we need to stop doing that. I mean, for one, it places a bigger burden on us on our property taxes, which we know affects our housing costs, which is a problem in itself. But also that funding is there. It's available. We just need to actually use it and say, you know, like a lot of the legislators said last session, education needs to be an ongoing priority. Unfortunately, the measures that went through with House Bill 3, the 13th paycheck, these kind of things, those were short-term remedies. And, you know, most of the people who passed that legislation that I've spoken with have agreed that that's a short-term fix. And so unless we're doing something that has an ongoing trajectory, like using more of the state funds, we're going to see the same problem where we're not sufficiently funding education. We also need a system that departs from the high stakes testing. We give incentives and rewards to school systems and punishments to others if they don't keep up with certain test scores. We call them low performing schools. One of the things that I have a problem with that system is it doesn't fairly and accurately track student progress. You know, if you have a classroom full of students that would have made a 30 at the start of the school year and they all pass with a 70, that's success. If you're comparing it to a classroom where every kid would have started at a 70 and got up to an 80. If we're all we're looking at is the one test and say this room full of kids made a 70, this one made an 80, and we don't look at where they came from and other benchmarks, we're not accurately grading that teacher's performance or that school's performance. And when we use that to make decisions about how to finance schools, that's going to have a disproportionate disadvantage and effect on minority students. We know that. We know that that's the case with a lot of the schools in the Houston area. I mean, areas like that where, you know, they've suggested an alternate school system that's not local, but someone gets appointed to run those schools and these kind of things. Every time that's brought up, it's in a very...
So you would want a higher recapture rate for those school districts with a higher minority to offset some of the levels that they use for judging compensation packages?
So my bigger issue is actually that we're using the high stakes testing to judge performance. Okay. I think that's where we need to start.
And that's unfair to minorities, so, right?
Well, Anthony just dinged, but we also need to let the...
Yeah, go ahead. So,
oh, I was just saying I agree.
Well, then you're out.
Were you still? No, no, no. I want to go.
Okay, I'm just checking.
Were you done? I wasn't trying to...
I don't think there's
anything
we're going to disagree. I just thought
No, that was a starting conversation. So we'll let Anthony talk about his education platform and then we'll have Tom.
Right. So when I was a teacher, the healthcare premium took out one third of my salary. The healthcare, so I was knocked down to probably about 28K a year after that. So healthcare premiums need to lower.
And you don't, do you have kids? Do you have a family?
I don't even have kids. So let me mention that.
No, that's why I was.
The head of the history department that I taught in, once he had one minor and a spouse, it was absolutely ridiculous, his deductible. So he had to drive Ubers over the summer to take care of his family. And that's completely unacceptable for, you know, the things that educators do for our kids. So that's one thing, healthcare premiums and salaries for the teachers.
So what would you do? Legislate a low. There you are. You're sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to hear, what are you going to do in Austin? What are you going to do to change that? What are some of your ideas?
Right. So I have three ways we need to fund this, three primary ways. Number one is we need criminal justice reform. And I've spoken with North Dallas school administrators that completely agree. We're wasting tens of billions of dollars incarcerating low-level nonviolent offenders. One example I like to bring up, Grandma stole $80 worth of clothes for her kids.
Her.
And, you know, you got to do your time if you do the crime. But she couldn't make bail.
Sure.
So she was in there for 6 months for stealing $80 of clothes. And I think you and I and anybody can agree that that's a waste of taxpayer money and also a moral issue because she can't take care of her kids. And so 3 out of every 4 county inmates aren't even convicted yet.
So that money you would use for the public education system.
Yeah, we need to save that for public education.
Okay, I'm just trying to get to that.
And let me also mention how deeply even more it can affect tax dollars, because if the parent, and I saw this as a teacher, if the parent is gone from the kid because of a low-level nonviolent crime, then that spirals into more tax obligations, because then that parent can't put the home over the head, can't help the kid in academics, the kid falls behind, and then they permanently fall behind a lot, and they can't become self-sufficient in the economy. So then that spirals into more and more people needing welfare. So
right.
If we can keep those savings, it multiplies, we can funnel that back into property tax and also education funding. The second way is we need to put some oversight on our procurement and corrupt tax spending at the state capitol. The procurement is very ripe for corruption. Xerox defrauded Medicaid for $1 billion in 1 year, $1 billion year tax dollars. So billions of dollars being wasted there. And also there's something called the equal and uniform provision, lopsidedly gives property tax relief to large industrial properties. We need to balance at least $2.5 billion of those savings. They get $5 billion a year in an unfair way towards residential tax saving, property tax savings on the resident side, so that we can lower the property tax while funding education.
Okay. What do you think
I was going to disagree a little bit on the criminal justice with some of what Anthony said. Criminal justice reform, absolutely essential. Bail reform, absolutely essential.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether or not savings there, especially in our city and county jails, are going to make it into the state general fund and therefore help our schools or make it into the ISD budget, that's a different matter. So I'm not as optimistic as he is that that's one avenue for finding additional funds. But, you know, education, I guess for all of us is personal. We've all gone to school. But, you know, for me, I'm the product of public schools. And my mom was a 28-year public school teacher. And I've seen the impact she had on students. I had one woman a few years ago just come up to me at a restaurant and give me a bear hug because she felt like she was hugging my mom by hugging me. And she relayed that she can't imagine having gone through the hardest part of her life without my mom. And so I'm really proud of the difference that my mom made as a school teacher. And unfortunately, we just do not support our teachers enough. Anthony hit on a little bit of it. The retired teacher benefits are abysmal. We fund our teachers' retirements. We are 50 out of 50 states and by a mile. In terms of the support we give our
but I want to know what you're going to do.
The funding.
Yeah.
So the number one weakness with HB3 is that there's no sustainable funding mechanism. While the funding increased by about $6.2 billion for our schools this past year,
yes.
Which is fantastic. And then we had about $5.1 billion went to property tax relief. Both great needed steps. But there is no sustainable funding mechanism. And that's why the legislature was talking about a 16% sales tax increase. I mean, a 16% tax increase on all Texans, because they're looking at the projections and they're saying, geez, we can't maintain this increased level of funding down the road. So we need to find out where we can get that funding. I do believe that we've touched on healthcare reform. I'd mentioned how much additional money would be pouring into the Treasury if we expanded Medicaid. So that's one thing. Anthony did hit on the equal and uniform loophole, which is a benefit to commercial property owners. In essence, and this is something I heard Representative Beckley mention, and I hope I'm getting what she said correct. Right? But I believe she said that, you know, homeowners pay taxes on about 90% of the value of their homes. Commercial properties, they pay taxes on about 60% of the value of their property. And clearly what we've done in this state is we've shifted the burden of funding our schools onto homeowners, not onto corporations. And I'm not advocating a big tax increase on commercial properties. I'm just saying we have to have this conversation about who should bear the burden here. Shouldn't we all be paying about equally a percentage there? When you're looking at 90 and 60, that seems pretty out of whack to me.
Go ahead.
So, and I was going to say, we can talk about the reforms to the franchise tax. But the
we'll get into that other stuff. Well, you know, you had a question for Anthony, I believe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as someone who has been through the school system, I have educators in my family, but I haven't been a teacher. I mean, my sentiment is that we need to have public school funding for public schools, not voucher programs, not where money is in a different system of accountability, but for the actual public schools. And I just wanted to hear your thought on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Public school, that's where it needs to go, because once again, I think what you're trying to touch on is empower Texans, private school voucher kind of show. Yeah. So 1,000% against that. So Jeff Leach, the incumbent, he's an Empower Texan guy by action. He kind of disassociates himself right now, but by action and his bills, he still is. And their drill is to privatize education. And that will make it unaffordable to a lot of kids, like the ones I taught down in Oak Cliff. And that is anti-American, funnily enough, because the most American principle is the land of opportunity, where everybody, rich or poor, no matter what station of life you start in, has opportunity. So public school needs to be number one. And that's what everyone, Rocio, Tom, and I are defending, is that public school is accessible, to everyone, so all people have opportunity.
Well, let me jump
They're trying to privatize
let
it.
Let me jump in, because...
What are you going to jump in about? Because we have to take a hard break.
I hear the question. And Steve, close your ears real quick, because Lord knows I'm not about to get up here and advocate for a certain political group that may have just been mentioned. But what I want to voice as a parent, and the frustration I think is somewhat stemmed for parents, is especially myself, because I went through this, was when you find yourself as a parent in a situation where the public school system is no longer working, and it's not necessarily to be blamed specifically on that public school system, but as a parent, I have to make the choice, okay, well, I have got to get this child out of this situation. And then you go and explore what it costs to go to private school, and that number is 17 grand or higher. And that's just like starting at 17 grand. As a parent, I found a solution. You know, I was able to advocate, and, you know, everything is hunky-dory. But it was frustrating to me that to be in the position that I was in, and my school couldn't necessarily wiggle too much. I couldn't. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at having to pay extra. Now, I'm not advocating for money, tax dollars going to private school. I'm just trying to say some of that has stemmed from the fact that where we've gotten ourselves in our public education, i.e., I'm sure part of that consequences because we're not paying our teachers enough and we're not, you know, supporting their retirement enough. That could be where that's coming from. And so what do you say to that taxpayer? Because it is a reality. We can't just all say it's all things Empower Texans.
Right.
So,
And you definitely bring up something that is a real frustration.
I was so angry because
the Sherry Salas show. Go ahead.
The thing is that I want you to hear, Anthony, is that I was mad because in that moment I felt like a traitor in my head that I wanted my tax dollars so I could go put it on this private school, because heavens knows I wasn't wanting to jump ship from public school. I love public school, but that's kind of like, I get frustrated when this conversation comes in as a one way or another or an all or not, because I'm here to tell you it's not.
And we're going to take a break on that.
We
have to acknowledge our sponsors. But so far, so good. It's very civil. I just don't want to say to Anthony, try not to knock the table, because that will come up on our recording.
Is my audio off?
No, you're good. I'm just saying those points you're making, everybody can hear them.
Okay.
So please do that. Everybody's doing great so far. So we're going to take... just a couple minutes. We talk about our sponsors because they do pay for us, and that's a good thing. So Elevated Roofing has been our premier sponsor since day one. This is like our, 25th show, Shari? 26th?
If you say so.
Somewhere around there. And Elevated Roofing committed to us from the beginning that they love the idea of coming and talking about Common Ground, whether it be politics, whether it be issues, from our issue on vaping to cell towers to legalization of marijuana, which was a really good show, by the way. And they've supported us no matter what the political topic. So we want to thank them for being our sponsor, for doing everything they do for us.
Sorry.
And their phone number, if you need a roof, if you have a problem, I don't know if anybody had any hail damage, if you're out there in our audience, I would definitely contact Elevated Roofing at 469-200-0582. They come to your home. They don't charge you for any consultations. They do full service. I had them at my house, and they were just tremendous. They really helped me out with my insurance carrier, made sure that all my deductibles were taken care of. They used magnets to pick up all the nails on my lawn and driveway. It was pretty good.
I wish those were mandatory for all roofing companies, Magnus.
And they have their own painting division, too. I actually used them for my front door. You know how that Texas heat just destroys your front door? They gave me a very reasonable price. Not because they're a sponsor, but because they do a good job. And then I know that Sherry wants to talk about Bell & Sparrow.
I love Bell & Sparrow. It is a faith-based group, woman-founded, woman-led, and these ladies reach out to all sorts of women that are struggling, be it from reoccurring from addiction or incarceration and or just, you know, never had the ability to support themselves, and they help lift them up, offer them to learn a trade. They've in the past sold jewelry and textiles and stuff, and empower ladies to be able to support themselves. They've just recently added a new project called Stella's Projects. It's kind of exciting. And so
Stella's Projects.
And what it is, it's kind of the same thing, empowering them to do a trade in it, but this trade in it's on consumables. And so right now they're working with some honeybees. It's actually very exciting. Right now through January, they have a charity event going on with through Tips Treats. I don't know if y'all have them. And for every dollar you spend there, if you go to their website and put into the charity code. Oh, I like Anthony putting his thumbs up.
It's amazing.
If you put in Bell2020 into the coupon code, it'll donate 10% to Bell & Sparrow. And at the end of the month, whoever has the most wins a $10,000 check to their charity, which is a very big deal. So, and then they also have an event coming up in April for homeless women. I don't have all the specific details right now.
We'll get it on the next show.
Yes. So look for that. Love them.
So go to their website at bellandsparrows.org, and you can help this really amazing charitable group. In fact, they don't pay for their own sponsor. They have an anonymous person that actually pays for their sponsorship. So none of their funds that you contribute to their charity will be taken out for our show. And I think that's really important. And our last sponsor is Brace Humanity. With the holidays coming up, Valentine's Day coming up, if you're looking to get your spouse an amazing bracelet, and he also contributes to charity as well. He has Napa leather, Stingray leather, and a yacht rope. Very reasonable price for men and women. They're in Neiman Marcus and Nordstrom, but he's offering special discounts on his website at bracehumanity.com. So that's our sponsors for today. And I'm going to open it up with maybe...
Anthony wanted to answer to
me. Oh, boy. Go ahead, Anthony. Answer Sherry's question.
Okay, so I think choice to an extent is a very reasonable request of, you know, the constituency in our state. I believe that public education, though, should be the core, and different choices should be a supplement to public education, as opposed to Jeff Leach, who wants to make private school and all the other things, and school vouchers at the core, and then public education to supplement. So that's the difference. And what I want to tell you is that I think you to an extent may have fallen under their trick. And what their trick is that they purposely and subtly and sneakily defund public education to make it worse, so that they can, and let's be honest, not a lot of people pay attention to state politics.
So is this a conspiracy? Or you?
No, this is the truth. This is okay. The truth. Year after year, you can see it in their actions. If you do the research, they'll defund public education, and then they'll say, oh my gosh, what's happening to public education? Here's the proof that it's going bad. The statistics are showing. But it's their actions of defunding it in the first place that are making it go down, so that they can turn around and say, look how bad it's going. We need to privatize. That's the drill.
Do you agree with that, Tom?
Well, one of the things I'm really focused on that he just said is that you'll especially hear from the incumbents in this race and across the state. They'll be talking about how great HB3 is. And in isolation, yeah, it's a positive step. But in truth, it basically just restored funding that the legislature cut back in 2011. So, you know, and that is something that I think we lose that perspective over time. So there definitely has been those cuts. The state at that time refused to touch the so-called rainy day fund, and instead, cut public education. So I think that's important. You know, and he's mentioned Jeff Leach, who's been rated with an F grade for multiple sessions for his support for public schools. This last session, I think he received a C because he voted for HB3, but one vote in favor of public education.
So who rated him? Just so we have clarification.
One of them is Project Educo
okay.
is the main one. And there is another organization that I'm forgetting. There's somebody who does a great job of putting together data. His name's Chris Tackett. I believe it's ChrisTackettNow.com.
Okay.
He actually has a visual on public ed and the incumbents and where they rank that he just released in the last week.
I mean, you all seem very credible candidates, I have to say, and there are a lot of similarities. So my next question, I'm going to start with Rosio, is, you know, why?
Because you started with Rosio every time.
But they just spoke.
Yeah, I think I took the mic, please.
But she's on my right.
I love you. I'm not picking on her.
You're picking on her. No, I like her woman empowerment. I like that. So I want to start with her first. So,
we're all about women empowerment.
There you go. She happens to be of that gender, so she has a little advantage. So I want your constituents, really, in a short blurb or whatever, tell your constituents why. I mean, these are great gentlemen across the table, for very, very credible candidates. But why should they pull the lever for you over them?
I think it's just the nature of my character, my passion for other people, the fact that I just never sit down. I'm always go, go, go. I've naturally trended into leadership positions over the course of my life. I mean, when I was in college, they started a philosophy club and the professors literally came to me and said, "You're going to be the president. We know you have the drive, the intellect, make it happen." Whenever the Dallas Association of Young Lawyers developed a special interest group called Moms in Law, Christine Leatherberry was the founder, but she tapped me, you know, because she saw my involvement in leadership in the organization that came naturally and said, "You're going to be a co-chair with me." And I took that position. And I've just seen that happen over and over the course of my life, that once I'm in something, if it is worth my time, I am going to give it everything I have. And right now, my motivation, my passion, my attention is turned to how do we make District 67 better? I've supported other candidates in the past, and I have found a lot of satisfaction and meaning in that work. But I think it's time for me to say, the time is never going to be right. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. I have a law practice. I have all this other stuff going on. I can't wait for the time to be convenient. I need to do it because the situation calls for it, and I need to rise to the occasion. I really believe, you know, having spent all this time in the district, having different spheres of influence, and just this desire to do something for my community, it's the right time for me to be in a leadership position in this capacity.
And Tom, I'm sure everybody's going to be similar. They're all going to say you're passionate and you care about your constituents, but and that's good points that you've always been picked as a leader, and that's an attribute to you. But Tom, why should they pick you over the other three candidates?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to, in my case, experience, skills, knowledge, and perspective. We talked about my experience working on Capitol Hill. So I've got that legislative experience for several years. I was there. I'd be able to hit the ground running, fighting for our shared values. I do think my legal background is an asset in terms of my ability to analyze complex situations and choose the best path forward. I also am somebody who has been moved for the last many years by what's happening in our communities, our state, and said, "Hey, this is not consistent with my values. I believe we need to help each other out. I believe we need to take care of each other." And that's why I walked into the Collin County Democratic Party office and said, "How can I help?" a few years ago. And I take the perspective that, and I think we have plenty of evidence over the last few years, that we're not going to get the change that we seek unless we have new leaders. And so I spent a considerable amount of my free time the last many years knocking on doors, calling voters on behalf of other candidates, other Democratic candidates in Collin County in particular, but also in Dallas County, and helping them raise money. And then I've also served on the Collin County Democratic Party Commission and Committee, and then served as a delegate at the state convention. And so I've been moved by that, and I am passionate about making that difference. And I mean, it's the desire to affect change, positive change for all people, that is why I've gotten involved again, and why I sought out public service and through working for a congressman on Capitol Hill back in the day. And I've got other prior government experience. But so that's some of it. It really does boil down to that knowledge,
and
skills, and perspective.
Yeah, so first thing I want to say is that it's most important that somebody that represents people wins rather than lobbyists. And I think everyone in this room, including Lorenzo as well, is their hearts with the people. So that's the most important thing. I'm a person who has a professional background of working in business and teaching and also at the state capitol. So I have a background where I have an economic sense for your job needs, a educator sense for your kids' education needs. And also with the legislative experience, I have plans for all core civil, household finance, and economic issues solely centered for the benefits of ordinary people and only ordinary people. As far as just who I am as a person, I'm a person who understands the humanness in other people, Democrat or Republican. I don't fall for all the Fox News or CNN jibber jabber. You know, to be honest, at the end of the day, both of them answer to their shareholders. They don't care about the perception they give to Texan or American people. I think the best way to get to know people is just talking with them. And what I see is Republican, Democrat, swing voter, the average person is a great person. You know, in Plano, I grew up knowing, you know, the kid that was well off or the kid that was struggling. You know, I grew up on the Republican side of town, even though I'm running on the Democrat ticket. And, you know, most importantly, I think working down at the high school in an economically disadvantaged area is what the most impactful experience of my life in understanding what being a human being is. And at the end of the day, if you just sit down and talk with people, even if they're of a different political stripe, you'll just see that that they're just a human being, that and that their experiences have influenced their direction in their life. And if you see the humanness, we can cooperate and work towards good things. Where at the end of the day, we all want the same things. Right. And I think that that's the characteristic. Ahead,
so I want to jump in here because of what you just said. It kind of led me to something that I'm mm-hmm. curious about as a voter coming up is mm-hmm. the redistricting. So, you know, I read a lot of all of y'all's, I can't remember if Lorenzo's, but there's a lot of mentioning on the redistricting and what's going to be different.
Sure.
And here's the thing that I want to ask what your position is, because right now it's being implied that the district lines are drawn a certain way. What do you do as a legislator to prevent the pendulum from swinging from one way to the other? Because you just said, I'm not a Fox News, I'm not a CNN person. So I think that some of the voters are kind of frustrated with we're going from one to the other. So what are y'all?
Yeah, I mean, isn't it the party in power usually, you know, like yeah. right now you're not the party in power. So, yeah, it's really unfair that GOP is going to draw the lines. But if it was the other way around, the Democrats
right.
were.
A lot of legislators.
So how do we get around that? Go ahead, Rosio.
A lot of legislators have actually proposed having an independent committee do it. And that's something that I would stand behind is let's do it in a way where you're not thinking about where the lines are for your reelection.
And you're not just saying that now if you're elected as
right.
a legislator.
Absolutely. I've put it in writing.
Well, as a first legislator, if you're standing in Austin and it comes up and you have your fellow Democratic, you know, legislators who, I mean, we all know the game.
And we know how politicians change once they get to Austin, too, right?
That's right. And we need a nonpartisan redistricting commission. And I think that is fundamental, and it's a way to preserve our democracy. Because, and I say, when it comes to redistricting, we have nothing less than our democracy on the line. You know, when you have the politicians picking their voters and not the other way around, there's something fundamentally broken. And that's what we have in the state right now. I'll admit, I have heard some Democrats say, hey, we shouldn't hand over that power to a nonpartisan redistricting commission, because in other states, for example, you know, once Democrats have the power here, we need to be able to skew the field in favor of Democrats to counterbalance the benefits and advantages in other states that Republicans have. And I mean, as a Democrat, there is a little bit of appeal to that, but it fundamentally that is destructive to our democracy and to our state.
And I'm glad that you guys are speaking this way, because that's one of the things that we try and do as a show. Because,
and actually what you just said makes me so happy just to hear the fact that you're willing to say it on the show. That's
right.
What our show is definitely
trying. Yeah, because, you know, the
create.
Partisanship is just, it creates such a divide in this country. And that's what, you know, debate and compromise is what's made this country great. And the immigrants that have come in and put forward, you know, their ideas, and everybody evolves from it. You know, I call, you know, America, you know, a salad bowl, and everybody is a different vegetable. And that's what makes a salad taste so good, right? You know, you have all different cucumbers and tomatoes
and
whatever.
I think we've all attended at least one redistricting hearing, because they've had several, and it's not a fresh idea that we're bringing to the table. I mean, a lot of the incumbents.
But we'll talk to the Republicans about that too. Go ahead, Tom.
No, go ahead. I am interested in that perspective. I mean,
well, you can hear it on the show.
I mean, unfortunately, the way that the system is set up right now in Texas, even if Democrats do take the House, we are still will still be holding a weaker hand.
Right.
When it comes
to eventually. So real quick question.
But the census, it's coming. And so with them having the majority, if they did, especially you guys being in Collin County, considering what was
and how close your race is going to be. Let's face it, Leach barely won last time.
And there's
a good chance that a Democrat could take that seat. So just quick question, and I'll go around the table. So yes or no, or just brief, you know, answers. So term limitations, are you for it, against it?
I'm for it.
And you, Tom?
We'd have to talk about what those term limitations are, but I actually have real reservations with that, and that's because of I've worked on Capitol Hill, and I've seen that expertise makes a difference, and it's the legislators who were there longer had more expertise.
Well, then follow-up question, if the term itself was changed, so instead of running for office every 2 years, you got to be in office a max of 12 years and you only had to run 3 times.
I'd have to chew over that one up because I don't know if I like that idea either, too, because the problem with term limits is you are actually taking the choice out of the voters' hands, right? At some point, they might say, hey, I love my representative. He has been phenomenal, and I don't want to lose him.
But that isn't a cronyism. I think that's why Anthony answered so quickly.
There is no doubt that there is some of that. And the question is, who should be responsible for kicking those people out? Is it the people, or is it a law based on a term limit? Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I am absolutely opposed to any term limits. I just think that we should be talking about term limits that are further out than just 3 terms, for example. When the Republicans took Congress in 94, they imposed term limits on their committee chairman. That was just 6 years, so it's 3 terms. And in that case, that's a little different because that was for committee chairmanships, but there was a big push to limit congressmen to just 3 terms. And my experience on Capitol Hill was the congressmen who were hitting their 3rd and 4th term, they were the ones that were finally developing some understanding about the issues and how the how Congress worked.
What about these career?
We did a show on term limits because I was kind of like full on yes term limits until we did that show.
Right.
And I actually had to think about it, and I was like, wait a minute, I feel like term limits and as supporting them are a consequence and a reaction to bad politics, because as a voter, I know lots of people in my life that are amazing leaders, and yeah, they're going to screw up here and there, but ultimately they could hold a position for a while, and I still think do a better job than half of another person that I know. So that's what I say about it.
What do you say about term limitations?
I actually liked what you said about not having to run every 2 years. Maybe 3 would be better. just a little bit more.
I totally agree with that. So, but career politicians, you know, I don't want to say my opinion on it, but, you know, I agree with what some of the things that you say, but the reality of it, these guys become, most people become career politicians and they just hang around and they feel
they're protecting a lot more than anything.
And that's the part that bothers me the most.
But I mean, again, you're taking the power out of the people's hands.
Right, I understand that perspective.
But I agree. And so the question there is, you have people that become entrenched who then just, you know, it's inertia, right? They don't really, if they're not contributing, then yeah, they absolutely need to go. If they're in bed with special interests, yeah, then they need to go. It's all about representing the people. That fundamentally, we have to make sure that we have representatives who are representing the people. And I appreciate what Sherry was just saying there, that it suddenly wasn't black and white for her.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I like to add that I'm for it with nuance, because Tom is correct, and that's my experience as well, that once you get some more time in there, you will be more effective. Relationships are pretty key to be able to get legislation through. I can't stress that enough. Relationships are key between legislators, so that does help a lot, but we do need a mechanism to get people up.
You got it. Don't worry about it.
I'm trying to help you out.
Thank you very much. But, you know, on the other end, what we see is people that have been in there too long that aren't serving the people anymore. So I think if we come up with a nuanced idea of how to keep the good ones in and the bad ones out, or maybe something like a reset button every once in a while to put in a term limit if things get a little bit crazy, to protect against.
I want to jump in on that. Sure. What Anthony said there about relationships is important. And in places where you have these term limits, you have a messed up incentive structure to a degree. And that is, you have people who are elected and they know they're not going to be there very long. They have an incentive not to develop those relationships. They're going to go in there and posture, and you're not going to build the common ground, which is what we're all about.
That's great.
Way to go, Tom. So,
good plug.
For those reasons, I have reservations about it. But again, as I said, I'm open to the possibility, especially, you know, extended ones.
Okay.
Ones
that are another quick question.
I'm not seeing the term limit itself as being the issue. If you've stopped representing your constituents, then maybe your problem is you're answering to special interest group, and that's what we need to, you know,
right,
remedy. That's what we need to actually address, right, and not the term limit itself.
Exactly. And I think Sherry's point was exactly right, which was the push for term limits is a response to bad governments, bad representation.
True. So I know that in each party you have your scale from moderate to, I don't want to say extreme, but from one end to the other. So how would you paint yourselves as a Democrat? Are you more on the liberal side? Are you moderate? Are you more, you know, you're conservative fiscally? How would you paint yourself to your constituents? What type of Democrat are you? Are you just a Democrat?
I think we're all progressive candidates. And I think I'm not speaking for y'all. No, I think our concerns for the community are pretty much on the same end of the spectrum, if there is one.
Okay. Well, I mean, even the Republicans have their, you know, we mentioned Empower Texans are extremely right.
I just feel like there are certain prerogatives, like being fiscally responsible, that are seen as Republican values, but they're really not. And they're a shared value. And we've brought up finance and school finance and how you can be fiscally responsible with that, and healthcare, and how you're actually saving cost. And so I hesitate to identify myself in a way that I think are kind of catch-all terms for things where we can really have shared values.
Do you agree with that, Anthony?
I agree. I don't like to label myself as moderate or progressive or liberal. I just view myself as, does it help people or not? I don't give a damn if it has a D or R next to it. That's the only qualifier.
Well, you chose a party. So
I mean, if it's a Republican bill that helps people, that helps healthcare, I'll sign on to it.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so the only thing that matters is what's right, what has research-backed facts to it that will help the economy, help people, help our needs. That's the only thing I'm concerned with, and that's what I stand for. And I'll fight for the values that represent people in a very firm, passionate way. But I'm not ignorant to the fact that we do need a level of relationship building as well with people from a different party in order to get things done. And that's just human nature. These aren't special people from another planet. It's just they're people that want to make friends too and have emotions as well. So relationship building is key. And that's the attitude I'll take in as well.
And Tom?
Yeah, I don't like labels because I think they get distorted. So I am hesitant to embrace some sort of a label. But I mean, for me, it is about problem solving. It's about bringing people together. You know, if believing that everyone should be able to access affordable healthcare makes me a progressive, then yeah, I'm a progressive. I also believe that we need to have solutions that work. So, you know, I have those values about making sure that we have strong schools that are well-funded and people can access the care they want, that we have common sense gun safety laws, things like that. If that it makes me a progressive, then those are my values. But I also believe that we need to make sure we have solutions that work and that there is a buy-in and agreement from a wide swath of the community.
And I hate to say it, but
are we almost done? Because we aren't done. Touch on the Second Amendment.
There are a lot of things. You want to talk about
real quick, Second Amendment. Just give it to me. Are you going to touch it or are you not going to touch it?
All right, Tom, you start.
Are you going to take my guns or not? Not what kind of guns?
Are you taking Sherry's guns?
I am not in favor of taking anyone's guns. That is not what this is about. I believe we have a gun violence epidemic in the state, and the state has failed to do anything. And I think the worst thing that we can do is inaction. And that's what's happening right here. I mean, it's probably a terrible analogy, but when you get trained to give CPR in an emergency, the first thing they tell you is do anything. don't just stand there and do nothing. And right now, I feel like we have that situation where we're doing nothing.
And you call weapons of war, I believe.
I do use it in terms of high capacity weapons of war is a phrase that's used in on my website. And I don't believe that we need to have those on our streets. But I would start back and say there's so much common ground on this in terms of universal background checks and red flag laws in particular.
And that's what I wanted to say because we don't have enough time.
Yeah, sure.
I know we could have
Yes or no. Go ahead, Anthony. Second Amendment.
Yeah, I am for your Second Amendment rights. My positions on it are things that NRA members agree with. I've talked with NRA members. They agree that people who show a violent past or have an inclination to want to use their gun for violence, there should be a background check on them to bar them from that. There should be private gun show sale. Private gun sale background checks. They agree with that. That's something we all agree with, and okay. I'm for it.
And Rosie, I'll give you a last word.
I'm of the same mindset. I mean, if we are, for whatever reason, denying you the opportunity to have a gun or taking your gun, there's going to be a very legitimate and good reason for it, either a violent criminal history or just something that says this person doesn't need to have a gun. I'm not saying let's get rid of all guns or get rid of your Second Amendment.
Antonin Scalia said
I was given her last word.
Constitutional. I apologize.
Go ahead, last word, Rocio. Just kidding. So I just want to thank our guests. We are running about 5 minutes over than we normally do. We do like just keep it an hour so we lose our audience and then like we're done with this. So there are a lot of things that we could have covered that we didn't, and we apologize to our audience. Maybe we'll get you guys back. We'll see how, we still have till March. I want to wish the best to the three of you and Lorenzo, who couldn't come, the best to him as well. You guys seem very credible, good candidates, and hopefully people research about you and meet you face to face and see what you're all about. I know it's a lot of door knocking, and then the next challenge will be Representative Leach come November. So the best of
y'all, whoever wins, you promise to circle back around because we're sending the invite out.
We'll be having Leach on the show, hopefully with one of you guys. And we'll talk then. So thank you so much, Tom Adair, Anthony Lowe, and Rocio Hernandez. Thanks for participating in our show. Thank you, audience. God bless. Next Thursday is James Trombley and Jared Patterson.
HD 106.
Republican primary. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.